Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to part two with the Dean and EJ, the Books Boys.
Woo! Whoa, baby!
So, PJ, the next book that I read is the German, the East German Spy Mistress. Now, this is by Natalia Pastukova and co-authored by a certain Mr. Peter Morris.
Nice. Sounds good. I like the title.
It's kind of a spy book. You know, you've got your mystery type stuff. You've got that East German kind of post-World War II going into the Cold War era type setting. I believe it is a sequel. There was the East German Police Girl also. Before this one by Natalia. And
so hold on a second. You're reading the sequel here, or
I don't know if it's a direct sequel in the sense that I was able to read this without having read the first one. I didn't feel like I was missing something, you know. But it's a series,
right? Sounds good.
You would love this not only because it's got that East German Spy Mistress. You already were intrigued by the title, but also it's got lots of jokes and humor in a Woodhouse-ian kind of way.
Okay, that's always good for me. Yeah,
it's just peppered full of a few little jokes.
Right ho,
here and there. There's a bit where there's some posh English chaps, you know, and they call in and they say something and say, "Oh, what's going on here?" And they say, "Oh, sorry, I should say rather." And he kind of corrects himself and puts like the English version. So I thought that was very funny, you know.
Oh, cool. And it's a fascinating kind of period, I find, you know, East Germany being, you know, locked itself away from the other part. And it's interesting, I find.
It is interesting, yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what happens in this book. We have a lady called Ulrike. She is the East German spy mistress. Okay, so she's the spy mistress. Now, we have another, so I'll go back a little bit into the book. Because she meets her cousin, and her cousin doesn't realize that it's her, but she does, and she sends him off on some mission, okay? But there's a little bit just before we get to that. There's a chap, Dardry. There's a lot of characters in the book, so it is difficult to keep up with them at times. But there's a chap, Dardry, and I include this note just as a way to show you the spy element. So he gets cornered by some people, and they... Dardry's the kind of corporal, the investigator, and there's a chap, Aziz, and they take his box of matches, and he thinks he's going to get away with being a spy, you know, and they take his matches, and he says, "Why have you got my matches?" And then they try to light some, and they say, they're duds, and half of them are duds, and he says, "Well, they got damp, you know," and the police are able to say, "Well, that's interesting, because we had a guy recently with some duds, and it turned out that..." And it was part of some plan, like the duds were actually, you know, encoded with like ink that would write a message or something. So there was a scheme behind it, you know. So there's that kind of stuff going on.
Cool.
So it's kind of cool that there's a couple of ingenious little bits like that peppered into it.
Nice.
But there's also large amounts of sex in the book. Like someone will just go to the bar and a girl will be beside him and they just be like, "Hey, do you want to have sex?" And she's like, "Yeah, cool." Like, it's that easy.
And I thought this was Woodhouse-ian, I suppose, sex and while talking Woodhouse-ian kind of.
It's kind of an interesting mix, yeah. And so there's the guy's running this kind of bakery, and he goes in and he sits. There's a very pretty girl near him, and he kind of says, "Would you like?" He basically offers to have sex with her as a prostitute, but instead of paying her money, he will just give her some sticky buns from the bakery. And he says, you know, "Oh, how about your sticky bun in exchange for these sticky buns?" So there's kind of this crude humor kind of thrown in. And she sleeps with him, of course. And I'm reading it thinking, this is unbelievably easy. But then it turns out, no, of course, it was a setup that particular time.
Right.
And she's working with the authorities, you know, trying to track down, you know, communist sympathizers and that type of thing. So sometimes it's so easy that it was a scam, you know?
Yeah, because I thought that was sounding a bit, okay, what kind of novel is this now?
But she just sleeps with him, though. Like, they doesn't find it's a scam until afterwards.
Okay.
So that's the kind of the joke turns back on itself then. But this guy Kohlberg, he then discovers that he gets called in to see the authorities, and who is it? It's actually his cousin Ulrika, and she says, we're going to send you on a mission. And he says, what, am I going to be killing people? And she's like, well, yeah, you'll be killing people, but you'll also be doing some other stuff. And we kind of get the feeling that she's going to use him for some silly missions almost, you know, just like, no, he's probably not going to be doing anything really that important. At least that's the impression that I get. But Ulrich is now traveling all around the place. At one point, she's in Northern Ireland, actually. I think she arrives at Larne Port, and then she's in Carrick, and she's over in Derry. She doesn't make it over here to kind of Belfast, Lisburn area, but she's just traveling around. She's there, you know, they're over in like Egypt and stuff. There's some clues relating to Zeus, which turns out to be the Suez Canal and this kind of stuff. So there's a lot of traveling around, you know.
All right, okay. Which is, you know, the Suez Canal. That's, isn't it Zeus spelled backwards? Is that the kind of thing?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So that was an easy clue.
Clever. No, but it's still kind of, clever. But I like that Derry. Yeah, you know, I've got a fun spot for Derry.
Yeah. Because of the Derry. I've never been.
Well, Derry Girls. You haven't seen Derry Girls?
I've seen the show, but I've never actually been to Derry / Londonderry. Never in my life.
Huge bad, though, anyway. But anyway,
But there's nice flashback scenes where she goes to live with her Uncle Oscar because her parents just can't deal with her anymore. And then her uncle promptly ships her off somewhere else because she's a hot potato niece who wants to, you know, kind of sleep around with all the boys. So he can't deal with her.
This is set in the 80s, maybe. What kind of period in? Because, you know, East Germany was a good, the Cold War era. What's hard?
The year on the back is 1955.
Oh, 1955. Okay, right before the Berlin Wall. So just kind of after the Second World War. Okay, I was thinking later.
But yeah, basically the uncle sends her off with a tobacconist and kind of says, okay, you go and work with him and, you know, I wash my hands of you because you're essentially sleeping around and that kind of thing. It's interesting because the book is, you know, written by a male and female team, but it is the female author whose name is kind of in big on the front, and yet the book is uncharacteristically full of kind of crass sex bits, you know. And there's some bits that are difficult. You know, there's a part where a girl actually is there's one guy who's killing women. And then even after they're dead, he's just like, well, I'm just going to have sex with her here anyway, because like, but he's got this kind of social problem, like all the girls are rejecting me. So he's kind of got a vendetta against them almost, you know, and even after he kind of kills her, he's like, well, I'm just going to slip my hand up her skirt here. And, you know, the book goes into a bit more graphic detail that I'm not necessarily going to go into, but at the same time, it's not really too graphic. Like it is always trying to, for the most part, it's trying to keep up a relatively lighthearted vibe with those kind of Woodhouse-ian little quips coming in here and there. It's kind of a bit over the place. Like, it's got the graphic parts, it's got the spy parts, it's got the jokes, you know, it's accomplishing a lot.
Sounds like a mix of, sounds like almost as if they're blending a lot of genres. Is it a bit postmodern in that sense, in the sense of, like, you know, mixing the genres that are unexpected a bit? Are they kind of?
Yeah, I suppose it is a bit. And again, with the travel all over the place and different characters coming and going, it can be difficult to keep up with it. You know, you've got to take your time with it.
Okay.
But it was an enjoyable enough read. And I'll just give you another example of the spy stuff. One that I particularly remember. These two cops come to her house, Ulrika's house, and they're having a chat and they're both kind of sizing each other up. And eventually she gets the gun. And she's kind of like, ah, they were so stupid. Like, they let me get the gun. And then the cops were like, yeah, you thought we were stupid. Look at the gunpowder in your sink. Like, I already found your gun and emptied it before you even thought to grab it, you know? So it's always kind of like being a step ahead, which I think is pretty cool.
Right, okay.
One of my favorite jokes is he took an overdose of bleach 3 days ago. And Kohlberg says, oh, is there a correct dose of bleach? And she says, well, that depends on your opinion of the recipient.
That's actually pretty good, yeah.
So there's a few like that, you know, so it's a nice mix. So I'm trying to just give you a few samples of the humor, the spy stuff, and the sex stuff to kind of, and just mix it all together in a pot, basically, and that's what you have.
Well, you know, it's very trendy that where they call it postmodern literature when, you know, not just because of the era post-war, they usually refer usually either after Second World War or after the Berlin Wall fell down. Mm. But I mean, authors like Murakami, for example, or Salman Rushdie, like, you know, 70s, 80s onwards, particularly, they started blending genres and like even imitating famous works like Don Quixote or P.J. Wodehouse or Shakespeare and then adding some kind of sci-fi or horror element. So it's very, that's what it sounds like to me. Like all these postmodern authors, like really well-read authors, you know, who kind of can't help but give homages to very different kinds of authors and then put it on one novel. I kind of feel two ways about it, to be honest. I sometimes enjoy it, but sometimes I feel like the simplicity of just a beautiful story is more important for me than a constant homage.
Yeah,
it sounds like
it,
both
this
has an interesting story and a lot of homage.
Yeah, so I think what's great is that the actual story works, whereas, you know, if I read just a Wodehouse and I just see these jokes, yeah, I know you like him, but I find that it lacks an actual plot. You know, this is an actual spy plot, so it's perfect, you know?
Yeah. I know what you mean. Sometimes these postmodern authors, they just cover the lack of story with just, here's my pastiche of the last 10 books I've read.
Yeah.
And I'm imitating his life, yeah. Yeah.
What's nice as well is, you know, I love the English humor. So they're making fun of the posh English guys, you know, rather, and one of them's called Sir something or other, even though, you know, he's not a real Sir, and all this kind of stuff. So I like that. But we do have a few bits of social commentary about corruption at the time in like Arab nations. You know, it's very easy to get anything done if you just slip someone a few notes, a few bills, and all of a sudden you can kind of get things done a bit quicker. Or they even say at one point, is that not illegal? And it's like, well, yeah, I'm sure the king's really worried about it, like this particular case, you know, like kind of like, yeah, it's illegal, but no one really cares.
Sounds good. And then it's a pity we can't go. Yeah.
I said there's also a magazine article called How to Discombobulate English Snobs, which I quite enjoy that title. But yeah, it would have been nice to chat to the authors about the book.
Yeah, I know, but I can't chat to them all, can you? I mean, that's a bit.
Oh, PJ, I think we're getting a call here. Let's see who have we got on the line.
I'm Peter. If you're talking to me,
Peter. Peter, how's it going?
Very well. I'm in contact, so that has to be a good start.
That's fantastic, Peter. Well, look, we're delighted to have you on the show. Dean was just talking about your book, so it's lovely that you're calling.
We were just talking about the East German spy mistress. Peter, do you want to tell us a little bit? So on the front cover here, I've got, you know, Natalia, and then inside, of course, Natalia, Pastukova, and Peter Morris. So what's the writing vibe here? Like, is it sort of a 50-50, or is it, you know, are you assisting Natalia? What's the setup here?
The original scheme and a lot of the bits and pieces, a lot of the elements do come from Natalia, who is Russian. They're a very competent linguist. But she met my brother, who's head of English at a posh girls' school, and said, do you know someone who can help me, you know, bring in more colloquialisms and idioms and so forth? And so I have done a lot of the writing, or even most of it, really.
Right, okay.
But she's the originator.
And it helped her with the story and made it. Yeah, okay, I get it. Okay, interesting.
So you're the writer. So it's more Natalia's kind of the storyboard, kind of here's the ideas, and you're kind of writing it all, putting it together, essentially. Cool.
Well,
yes.
Very nice.
I was going to ask, is it yourself? So there's one thing I really enjoy about the book is the little quips and the little pieces of humor. Almost kind of P.G. Wodehouse vibes. Is that is that coming from yourself?
Yeah, well, I'm a bit of a thief, actually. If people say funny things, I comment it down and use it. I think by myself, I'm not particularly witty. But I'm, yeah, but yes, I have no shame about nicking things from people.
Well, look, we need
I
to
mean,
report.
The other thing that's crossed my mind, thinking about this book today as well, I mean, if you go back before the 1960s, when there was a bit of a sort of a watershed and the country became a bit more inward-looking, people were much more sure about their convictions. And in a way, that makes these people back in the 50s and 60s slightly, as long as you don't make the mistake of turning them into caricatures or become sentimental, it makes them a little bit easier to define than a lot of modern people.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there certainly is a lot of complexity in today's world, so that that could well be true.
Yeah.
I mean, well, yeah, one of Jane Austen's things, isn't it, about how you know if somebody's grown up is if they know their own mind, sort of thing. And I think today, some people are not quite so sure of their own mind, really. They're a bit bamboozled, really.
Right. So it was easy for you to maybe tune in to the 50s and have like these, not as you were saying, not caricatures, but clearly defined people who know who they are. So in some sense, kind of more graspable.
Right. And yes, that's right. They're sure of what they're doing. They have a bit of certainty right. about what they're doing. I mean, I'm 72. I'm quite an old guy, really. But, you know, I mean, my dad fought in Burma in the war. And I mean, I don't think he particularly wanted to be there, but they knew what they were doing type of thing, if you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what you're doing. You've got your objectives. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about your objectives. I mean, is there going to be more writing? Is there going to be another book, or what's the plan now?
I'm delighted you've asked that question. I'm just about to launch a book called Mary and Her Seven Devils. It's written in the first person as well. So I've rather ambitiously tried to put myself into the mind of a young female psyche, which is a university student who's being sort of, you know, she's tempted into sort of sexual psychopathies. She's tempted into trendy ideas, but she's got a bit of courage and a bit of character, and she comes out of it all right. And also by loving a rather lonely and poor student. She not only saves him, but she sort of deepens herself as well. Mm-hmm. So that's called Mary and the Seven Devils. So because it's slightly based on the idea of Mary of Magdala, mm-hmm. who of course was cured of seven devils, because she does make a few mistakes on the way, and she needs to be cured of them. So, but that's just me. That's not Natalia.
That's you yourself. Okay. And
it is.
Have you worked on it? It does say in the beginning here, you know, that there was a previous book, The East German Police Girl. Did you work with Natalia on that one also?
Yes, I did. Well, in fact, that was the first one. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that's a little bit more profound. That's about two young women. One who's a police girl because this is, again, East Germany in the 1950s, which is a pretty grim place.
Yeah.
And then the police girl is a pretty decent girl, but she's pretty active and tries to fix things and escape. Whereas the other one is a musician and organist, and she's fatalistic, and she just accepts a wrongful death.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sort of contrast between an active and a passive girl, really.
One thing I was just saying to PJ, though, a few moments ago, is what I really love is that this book is combining multiple ideas for me, at least. You've got the narrative, obviously, there's the spy plot, but we've got these spy elements, you know, the cops turn up at one point and she's gonna trick them by using the gun, and then they've already emptied the gun, you know, so there's like they're thinking ahead. But then we're combining that with these kind of P.G. Wodehouse style little bits of humor, so the likes of, you know, is there a correct dose of bleach to use? And this is what depends on who the recipient is. You know, these kind of little jokes that are being thrown in, coupled with like quite racy, sexy parts at times. So it's an interesting kind of mix of themes. And I just thought it was really skillfully kind of put together.
Thank you very much. No, I suppose you have to lighten it. You don't want to go down the... I mean, I'm not John le Carré, and it's not trying to be that. Because all these people are to some extent fumbling, and things don't work out as they plan. And I mean, the Ulrika, the spy mistress, she's very much the victim of circumstance. I mean, she's not some malicious person who's fought her way to the top. her father was the consul in Damascus before the war, and she's got a good education, so she knows languages, she's done cryptography and so on. So it's a sort of, she arrives there because it's the sort of path of least resistance and the best life open to her, not because she's a bad person. And I think that means you can have quite a bit of sympathy with her, even though what she's up to isn't particularly good.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, and to say what she's up to, you know, we've got her own cousin, Coburg, and she sends him off on some missions and things. But one thing I really enjoyed was there's just a little part where they arrive in Northern Ireland, which is, of course, where I'm from. So it was really nice to see they arrive at Larne, I think, is the port they pull in at. And that was kind of
cool. Yes, they do. That's right.
So there is a lot of traveling around, you know, and obviously they're over and they're speaking with some Arab gentlemen, and they're obviously in Germany and things and Sweden. There's a lot of traveling around. It's a lot to get to grips with, actually. There's a lot of kind of characters coming and going, and I had to kind of slow down a little bit. I have a tendency to race through books, and I had to kind of slow myself down to take things in a little bit, because it's lighthearted with its humor, but there, you know, there is an actual plot there that you need to kind of think about and engage with as well. So I think it's a good mix all around.
You've done a very thorough job, I have to say. I'm impressed that you've absorbed so much from it.
No, that's what we do. Before we let you go, we like to ask every author, and that is, if there's one book in existence that you wish you had been the person to write, what would it be?
I was very much impressed with Captain Corelli's Mandolin. I mean, in a way, like my book, that's got a lot of different strands. The crazy monologue from the Italian dictator, and there's all sorts of bits and pieces there. It's very profound. I mean, the book's far better than the film in that sense. So no book is completely you, is it? But no, I was very impressed with that. Sorry, what?
Who's the author from the book?
Is he Louis de Bernier? Is it?
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, of course. No.
Captain Corelli's Mandolin.
Right, I don't know it actually.
I also wish I had the same fame as he's managed to achieve, but we're working on it.
We'd all like that. Well, that's great. Do you guys have a website or anywhere that you want to plug or tell people where they can get the book, even just something like that before you go?
The East German Police Girl, allonestring.com.
There we go.
Cool.
Awesome. Well, Peter, it's been lovely having you on, and we loved the book. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and thank you so much for calling into Books Boys.
Thank you very much for inviting me. God bless.
No problem. Thanks. Bye-bye. Back to me. As if two Cervantes, a Cormac McCarthy, Rio Sonora, East German Spy Mistress. That's five books. And of course, I did cover three plays this month. And I'm two-thirds the way through the Harlem Coben book. So as if all that wasn't enough, I have two more books to cover that I read this month. I might have read too much, but anyway.
Well, don't worry. We know this about you. We would be a bit shocked if you only read one book or two. You know, that would be a bit shocked.
So the next book is only about 100 pages.
And I think I want to mention, I only surpassed you one episode where I read more than you, and that was a lot of children books. That was in November.
Yeah.
That was the only time, and there were children books to be fair, so it wasn't too difficult to surpass you in the amount.
Next month, with the month being a little bit shorter, and with me having a holiday during that month, and
is this a holiday?
Well, it will be. I'm going to London. I might, you know, I might do a long book as well. I wouldn't be surprised if I only do like three books next month, maybe four.
You can give me a chance to read a bit more books. I mean, like, I don't only have to rant about two books for a long time.
What happens if I don't read any, and then nor do you, and we're just relying on little Alfred one month to fill in the
gaps. we've always got great extra content, like talking about our lives and talking about literary theory, you know, like, you know, talk endlessly. We're endless, so, just like the Never Ending Story. Never Ending
Just like some of our episodes, that's the feedback we get. Exactly. This episode seemed like it was never going to end, you know? So. Neutral. So you might have heard of this chap, Miguel de Unamuno. I believe that you're a fan, and you've reviewed him before, and I read Amor y Pedagogía. Yes. I looked up what this meant. And the translation was love and pedagogy. And then I was like, yeah, I guessed pedagogy, but I don't know what that means. So then I had to read about, I didn't know what it meant in English. So I had to go and read about what pedagogy was.
To be honest, I'm not so clear either. Can you explain to me what is pedagogy?
Essentially, it is the theory of the education of children.
Okay, yeah, I thought it was something about...
I mean, yeah, if you know the book, then you know it. So it's essentially love versus like this theory of how to educate children, okay?
Okay.
And this is short. It's only about 100 pages. My version is 200 pages because, as you know, they love to include lots of...
they love that.
You know, intros and outros and...
The Spanish thing sometimes... literally from Miguel de Unamuno, I've got San Bueno Martir, which is a novella, very short novella, more of a short story. And literally the book is about 100 pages of theory from some academic versus about 60 pages of the actual story. And that's so often the case with Spanish books.
It is. They love it. I think it's a secret way to do the Anna Karenina method. You know, it's kind of like, this book's only 100 pages. We got to pad this one out.
The Spanish books are very expensive, so they must think of ways.
They're like 20 euros. They're crazy expensive. No, I know,
so they must make ways of making it. Just have some academic. And I do love it, but sometimes I feel like, okay, but who is this chap?
I never read it. I don't care about what someone thinks about the book.
But I just feel like I did buy the book for
because,
a
guys, why would you care about what someone else thinks about a book, eh?
Oh, careful now. Careful. That's very cheeky. Cheeky. Anyway, so
basically, this chap Carrascal, he gets with a lady. It's not the lady he thinks he'll get with, but he gets with a lady because it's just attraction. And they have a son, and they later have a daughter. But he has this theory about like how to raise children.
It is a story. I thought it was one of his philosophical texts.
No, this is a novel. Novella, maybe even. But they basically want to... He wants to raise a genius. So he has these theories about what he should do to raise the kid, particularly the son. He doesn't really care about the daughter, okay? He just kind of abandons the daughter. But he wants to raise the son, and the wife is so long-suffering, and he's always espousing these ridiculous theories, and she's always going around the house like, ay, Dios mío, qué teorías, and she keeps saying, you know, you're falling, you're continuing to fall. That's her catchphrases are, you know, what theories, or, you know, such theories, and you're falling, you're continuing to fall, kind of to ruin. Like, those are her two catchphrases that she keeps saying throughout the book, while he's doing this ridiculous stuff and telling her, you know, just let the kid cry. Don't give him any comfort. We don't have any emotional reaction with the baby. Why are you trying to give him kisses? You're going to spread germs and microbes to the baby, to our little son. You know, he's going to be a genius. Don't be doing this. Don't be doing that. And she's always like, how can you tell me not to give comfort to our son? And she's just trying to be like a normal mother. And their house, so even when someone asks her about the husband, you know, how is it going? And she's like, ah, mi marido, qué casa, ay, Dios mío, qué casa. Like, it's just always like, oh, what's going on here? What a house, what theories, what a husband. Like, it's just, she can't cope with his ridiculous theories that are always going on, you know? And he's not particularly good to her. I mean, she doesn't even appear near the end. She's not really relevant. It's just like, how can I get my son to be a genius? That's really all he cares about. And, you know, there's some, I'm not going to go into the details, but some stuff happens to the daughter and everything. He has no interest. And it all ends badly for him, but I'm not going to say how or why or who or what. But the son's not a genius. Surprise, surprise, right? What he actually needed was like a little bit of parental love. And he does not get that. His life turns out really badly because of it. But the whole time, the father is just kind of like expecting him to be a genius, and why isn't he being a genius? And, you know, don't kiss him, don't do this, don't give him any attention when he's sad, and all this kind of stuff. And the son also thinks the dad is crazy, like not just the wife. The son is like, my dad's a lunatic, you know, he's not getting any respect. And he goes off to try to write some book that he thinks, you know, will make him famous or whatever.
The dad or the son?
The son. And there's some funny bits as well where, like, I think he wants to teach him. He's not happy with what they're teaching him in school. And the son comes in, he's learned something. He says, like, the sun tells all the planets where to be. And the dad's like, the sun tells the planets where to be? What is this school teaching you? Personification of celestial bodies? Like, oh, this school is ridiculous. We've got to take you out of this school. You know, it's just like, okay, you're talking to a child, though. Like, it's just the way he's understood it. He doesn't really think the sun is talking to Mercury over there, you know? But
Interesting.
He's just very cold with the whole thing. At one point, the sun is cold. And the dad just says, cold doesn't exist. And the kid's like, yeah, but you're crazy. I'm really cold. And he's just like, forget your emotions. Just focus on your studies. You know, like he's a terrible father, actually, essentially. And even worse to the daughter because he pays her no attention at all.
Right.
And the whole, you know, it's interesting because I wanted to see more of it than I saw. Okay. There is a little love story, by the way. The son does meet a girl, but the girl can't end up with him. She picks someone else just because this guy's too eccentric in the end. And, you know, it's just not going to work. He's emotionally stunted because his father has purposefully made him that way. So it's all very sad. And what I don't like is that it is only 100 pages. Because I wanted to see a lot more, you know. It's almost in summary form, but I'm thinking, okay, you told him not to kiss him. You told him not to, you know, go in when he cries. There could be more. You know, like, if that had been Dickens, there would have been like another 300 pages of examples of like how the sun was raised, you know. It feels very quick, and that's my only real flaw with it.
Well, Unamuno tends to write very short books and novellas. It's always San Bueno Martir. I would have liked to see more of it, but it is only 50 pages. Just a bit of background again. We've mentioned Unamuno before, but just to remind you guys, Unamuno is a philosopher, author, professor of Salamanca, and he belongs to the generation of 98. That's 1898, because that's when Spain lost its final colonies, really, especially Cuba, with the Cuban Independence War.
Mm-hmm.
They got independent, or anyway, they had to sell land to Germany and to Spain. It's all mixed up. And literally this generation of authors really kind of were hugely disappointed. So Spain was always very proud of itself. But at that point, they began to realize, okay, Spain is losing the plot, literally. It's not a big empire anymore. It's nothing. So these are very pessimistic authors coming from 1898 onwards. Like, you haven't gone to Pío Baroja yet, I think. But when you get to him, like, I'm not sure if you can, you know, there. It's like one of the dark, like the Tree of Science is one of the most depressing books I've ever read in my life. So I'm not sure it's not everyone's cup of tea. It's influenced by naturalism, but not even, because it doesn't go into huge realistic detail. It's just about these intellectual characters who deeply get it wrong and end up really unhappy. That's a big theme in 98 generation literature.
So, but I do love this one. And I think I actually almost prefer, you know, these generations. And I've done a lot of Spanish lit now, you know, from books to plays and things, and even some poetry. You know, we looked at Vijay Inclán and Hernández and everyone. I really, really love these generations of Spanish writers a lot more than I loved, for example, Cervantes and Clarín and the real classics, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. And don't forget, Vinclan was also 98th generation and a bit later as well. But you got interesting authors. Okay. I know what you mean. That's actually called a Siglo de Oro authors, Cervantes and Lope de Vega. So that's called golden generation. So maybe you actually prefer this slightly more deviating, less known generation. So I think me too, actually. I like generation 98. Yeah. I like the later ones as well, like generation 27, 36, which is 36, more simpler. They're cool. I like that Spain, when you study Spanish literature, they really talk about generation of a certain year. I feel like most countries don't do that. They're really
Spanish literature is very big into
classifying like what year groups they're in, and they're very big into who was born, and everyone's got their own characteristics. And for example, generation 36, I think, is quite well known for being very simply written, kind of Hemingway style. Whereas 98, as you just said, is very pessimistic, stuff like that. And you've got older generations as well.
But, you know, I would much rather read, you know, Lorca than going and finding more Clarín or something, you know?
Yeah, because he's that simple generation. I think he is generation.
I think he's 36 or one of the. Yeah, one of those. Right. But anyway, this book here is 1902, this Unamuno book.
Yeah, but again, as I said, 4 years after that whole, you know, 1898 was a terrible year for Spain and for the morale, you see. So, interesting era.
But Algo de la Ciencia. I want to say something. I've thought about this, PJ. When I read something like an Orwell or, you know, 1984, these big classics, I always think they've done world building. If only they'd been so much longer and given me so much more.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the sign of a good book. Like, it leaves you wanting more. You know,
maybe you're right. Actually,
it wasn't Middlemarch that left me wanting substantially less. So
yeah, that's always good that when you want just a bit more. And I feel like you're what I said was the never ending story and. Yeah, you know, the book about heaven. I feel like, you know, the thoughts also just remain with you and you kind of extend it and you feel like, oh, I didn't. And even when you're thinking about it, you realize, oh, yeah, now after a few months, I realize what this meant and stuff. Like that. That's always deep, I find.
I'll just finish with one last thing I want to say from the book very briefly. There's a nice bit where the son is almost existentially kind of, you know, questioning his existence to his dad. And the dad is saying, like, science is everything. And, you know, the sort of thing that matters is science. And the son says, but what happens if science doesn't make me happy? And the dad basically says, you don't exist to make yourself happy. You exist to improve humanity. It's like, I didn't have you so that you could be happy.
Okay, you know what? To be honest, that's very cruel. And at the same time, I kind of get it from a kind of twisted perspective. Yeah.
I thought it was very sad. And at one point, the son then basically... His response is basically, well, if I can't be a genius in life, maybe I'll try to make an impact in death. And then there's just tragedy ensues. So it's actually very powerful.
But, you know, the same impression I got from Pío Baroja, his contemporary, was El Árbol de la Ciencia, which was, I think, written the year afterwards. If not, maybe 1910, actually. I'm not sure. But it's very similar in the sense of their academics. And they really want happiness. And science is almost in the way. It's a very similar theme. It's like progress, science, what the Spanish believed in didn't make them happy because in the end they lost it all. That's a big theme. And then they thought, oh yeah, we got science, we got positivism, which was a big thing in the 1870s. We still lost the empire, which no one's happy or suicide. First World War is just around the corner. You could feel it, you know, like First World War didn't just happen. There are things that happened before that which made you think this is escalating. So, like, it's an unhappy period. You know?
I would advise to pursue happiness, guys.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
There we go. So, I read one more book, PJ. This one. You might have heard of a little TV show called Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. And if you haven't, the episodes of our reviews are currently being released on our podcast feed. This is a 2004 TV show. It's only made six 22-minute episodes, and it's got some of your favourites from the IT crowd, Richard Ayoade, Matt Berry. I
love Richard Ayoade.
I showed this show to Robert, and we captured his reactions to this insane TV show, and we made a podcast of it. And now, almost 20 years later, the TV show has been followed up with a book. It's Garth Marenghi's Terror Tome. Curl up with this book and die. I don't know who this is for.
Okay.
But there will be a book tour, I believe, the 1st of April, and I will be attending that in Dublin. So,
1st of April, not just not a coincidence. You have mentioned this book. Yeah, this book you mentioned to me a bit, so I know a bit what's about to come. This was a literary masterpiece, would you say?
This was just under 300 pages. Of paper. I wanted it so much to be great. It's one of my favorite TV shows of all time, and I think I really needed this book to exist. But then the book is essentially a joke, right? So it's like, but now you've got to read 300 pages, and the novelty kind of wears off about, you know, 20 pages in, and it's like, oh, but now I'm just stuck reading a deliberately bad book. Like,
It's deliberately badly written. I mean,
that's the whole vibe. Like, the show is deliberately badly made. You can see the strings on the things, and you can see the camera cuts, and it's all kind of cheesy and bad. And this book, I mean, the stories are interesting, but they're this is not you know, high literature by any stretch of the imagination. And you're just kind of left reading this weird horror book. There's three stories, okay, which I'll just briefly touch on, but there's also fright breaks. So if something is too graphic, they basically say the editor told us to take this out, but if you flick to the back of the book, you can read it, and here's the fright break. And then it's like some really graphic, like one of them is graphic sexually, but the others are graphic with violence, like what's it called, those kind of movies like Videodrome and like body horror kind of stuff.
Body horror, yeah.
The body horror is coming into it.
The Cronenberg style.
Yeah. But it's also, it's written by Garth Marenghi, who is, of course, a fictional character.
And, okay, is it? I didn't know that.
Yeah, Matthew Holness. So he's written this book, and Garth Marenghi, in the TV show, Garth is a horror writer who's written hundreds of
Stephen
books.
King kind of person, yeah.
Yeah, written hundreds of books. But they're always like, you know, attack of the killer, you know, insects or a sponge or something. There's always something ridiculous, you know, and it's more of that. So in this book, it's Garth Marenghi writing it, and he's writing.
Okay, but one thing I didn't realize though is that he is the writer in the show, and so he's basically it's a book from the series, like that. One of the many books of the series, is actually come
essentially,
out.
Yes, it's supposed to have been. Cool. Started in the 80s and 90s and finally released, just like the TV show was. Except it's very confusing because Garth Marenghi is then present a fake character has written this book about Nick Steen. Nick Steen is the main character. He also happens to be a horror writer who has written hundreds of books, very similar to the Garth Marenghi books. So it's just these weird layers. And then in one of the stories, Nick Steen encounters an author called Gareth Marenghi, who is obviously Garth Marenghi. So we've got these weird kind of layers of these like B movie type, B book horror writers. Mm. So it gets a little bit confusing. And the story is always the same. And by the way, this is just what Matthew Holness does. Like, he made a movie on YouTube, a 17-minute short movie, which I watched, and it's about an old washed-up horror writer. Like, that's his only thing. It's always the same vibe.
Right.
So he finds a type... I don't know how to talk about this. He finds a typewriter, an ancient Chinese typewriter that was made before typewriters were invented.
Okay.
And the typewriter is calling out to him in a shop that sells antiques and eels. That's eels, the slippery animal. And he goes into the antique shop, which turns out to not be real, and it disappears after he leaves it. And he buys this typewriter, which is calling out to him to come and buy him. And then he falls in love with the typewriter, and there are several erotic scenes involving the typewriter. I don't really know how to review this book, but
this is a reference, by the way, I believe. It sounds like, I don't know the show too well, but I've read enough Stephen King novels. This sounds like a reference to Christine in the sense of the erotic love for an object.
Well, there's three stories, okay? So story one, it's focusing mainly on the typewriter. The guy starts writing these massive, 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 massive books, like super so tall that it falls over and kills a guy at one point. His editor, Roz, fires him. She says, "We can't publish this. It's full of like just punctuation and symbols. There's no coherent story. Your books aren't selling anymore," all this kind of stuff. He goes crazy. He's in this like really submissive relationship to the typewriter. He gets pulled into another realm at one point. The typewriter is actually a big monster. It's not really. It's madness. That's story one.
Sounds not too bad. Sounds kind of interesting.
Yeah. Story two. So how the first story. This isn't really a spoiler as such, but the first story kind of ends with saying, "Now all my nightmares have been unleashed upon the world." Just like in Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, when they open the gates of hell and all his nightmares get unleashed on the world. So it really is recycling ideas.
Yeah, right? That's true, yeah.
And the second story, Nick Steen has himself written a book about another guy who it's called Bride of Bone, this story. So they try to now he's like, there's another guy and he's meeting, I think it's Capello, who's a character from his book. And there's a guy in an insane asylum, but it turns out that he's not real. He's been pulled out of the book. And there's just these different layers of like what's real and what's not. It's very confusing. The guy wants to have like a skeleton army, and then he wants to cut off Roz's toes. And yeah, he wants a bride who is made out of bones and is a skeleton bride. Then the third book, Darker Fractions.
To be honest, like, I'm sorry, but like, you know, I know enough about horror literature and film that this is just like Dance Macabre from Stephen King. This is just like someone who studied horror literature and films and just put a lot of ideas into one. I just hear like 10 references.
Yeah.
Which is okay, but it's not calling out for originality.
No, it's not meant to be. It's also written with like lots of jokes where he'll over-explain a point because he thinks like the readers aren't intelligent, or there's loads of little footnotes, or it's deliberately kind of funny. That's his style, you know.
But your problem is, Dean, hold on, the problem is it's not particularly funny. That's the ultimate thing, isn't it? It's not actually that funny, fun. It's just a bit.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, there's a touching scene with Capello and Stern where they decide that one of them is going to take over ownership of the other guy's gun or something because of he suddenly respects him as a man. But there's that's funny. It's difficult to actually say that it's good. You know, that's the problem. It's difficult to actually say, you know, this is a genuinely enjoyable read. Here's a funny bit, though, an example of the humor. So he says, "Damn it, I'm sorry. I owe you a new battery. This is a car battery." And he says, "Actually, it's your car, so you owe yourself one, of course, and the lights." He says, "Technically, Nick, those lights were your responsibility as the designated driver of the car." He says, "Well, actually, I'm not the registered owner of the car, so any shortfall in battery capacity would ultimately affect your license. Damn it, Nick, I'm going to blast your bloody balls off if you keep it up like this." And then they kind of develop a friendliness for each other because of this like manly rapport where they've over-explained like driving license regulations. This is the attempt at humor, you know, and it's the same from the TV show, actually.
Okay. It doesn't sound like particularly.
No, I'll briefly just mention.
Has Robert read this or has.
I don't think.
Reacting to every chapter.
I'll briefly mention that the third story confuses things even more by having darker fractions. Where there's like multiple different versions of the writer, Nick Stern. Like he unleashes all these different versions of himself from a series of planned sequels about the books, where it's like the cowboy version and this version and that version. There's hundreds of versions of himself that are all trying to kill himself. And the book constantly says, well, darker fractions, that doesn't make any sense. Shouldn't it be dark parts? And then these long bits about like the title of the book not making sense and this kind of thing. I don't know what to say about this. It's weird because some of the scenes are very, very graphic, but then it's silly, but then is it really funny? It's very derivative, but it's meant to be. I just don't know what this is or who it's for.
And are you going to see him on his tour?
Yes.
Right, okay. So
I'm very excited.
Okay, so in some sense, you're still a fan, but from a B-movie lower perspective.
Yeah.
And is Dark Place Robert going to join you? Is there going to be like a special episode? Are you going to interview him? This is what kids want to know.
Well, that would be the dream, but I don't believe so. Unless Garth Marenghi, if you're listening and would like to call in, please feel free to do so. But I will certainly attend the book tour in my Books Boys t-shirt. I don't think Robert will come. I think the show was enough shock for him.
But I do love Richard Ayoade. I can't get enough of the chap, especially in travel series. I think he's a gift for humanity. So if you're out to Richard Ayoade, that's my compliment for you. I love your sense of dress. Just want to add that as well. Love you, chap.
He is. I'm sad that this guy, Matthew Holness, who actually plays Garth Marenghi, never really became famous after Dark Place.
Yeah, he didn't become like, it's not like Richard Ayoade.
Right. I don't know why. But that's the last book that I read. If anyone would like to get in touch, of course, you've got at Books Boys Podcast on Instagram. You've got booksboys@hotmail.com. And of course, booksboys.com is the website. Go to Patreon, etc., etc. And I think this month I'm going to end with one of my songs from the 2022 tapes. It's called The King of Nobody.
Ooh.
And that's all I've got. PJ, have we got anything else?
Well, I just want to say that if you like literature and you love books, why don't you just support us? Give us a free gift, vegetables, books. Maybe just give us a lovely letter.
Sorry, please do not send me vegetables. Those go to PJ.
The vegetables and the fruit goes to me, and the pasta goes to Dean. And
give like a chocolate cake or something. I'll take that.
I'll take the vegan chocolate cake. And we really appreciate you listening in. All I've got to say for this episode is read more Ende. That's what I've got to say, because he's a gem of a writer. And if I haven't expressed that again, then yeah, that's all I want to say. And also just want to say that, just feel free to keep on sending us books. And we're always delighted to receive them and to hear about authors.
Feel free to call in or leave us little voicemails and things like that. Yeah, we haven't had a voicemail in a while. Those are always nice to receive. So we're happy to get those.
And we're happy to be a service for you and to bring out different kinds of books, books that we love and books that we think are just unusual. And always lovely there. Always lovely to be there for you.
Quick insight into next week. I'm doing this next month, this Harlan Coben book, as I mentioned. It's a fun crime one. There'll definitely be some Dumas, and I don't know what's going to come after that, but there'll be an interesting variety, so hopefully that'll be good. But guys, if the DJ would spin that record, we'll be back in about a month.
See ya!
Days of glory, they are just a memory. Days of glory, I'm the king of nobody. Respected, used to be the one, though I was never elected. They used to call my name, bow at my feet. Now I'm gone, my downfall's complete. And here I stand and survey my grounds. From the top of my seat, I look all around. Where are all the men on whom I could rely? Where are my archers shooting arrows through the sky? 50% lie dead all around. Their bodies bleed out on the ground. 50% they have run away. Abandon me to live another day. Days of glory, they are just a memory. Days of glory, I'm the king of nobody. Days of glory, they are just a memory. Days of glory, now I'm the king of nobody. From which I stand atop and look down. Castle crumbling, crown tarnished, halls empty, army vanquished. And now I'm left here on my own. And how long I should have known. I scream to heaven, why oh why? And as the sun sets in the bloodstone sky. 50% of the love I had was false. demanded admiration, just like a false god. 50% is all that's left of me. Now I am the king of nobody. Days of glory, they are just a memory. Days of glory, now I'm the king of nobody. Days of glory, they are just a memory. Days of glory, now I'm the king of nobody. Days of glory, they are just a memory. Days of glory, I'm the king of nobody. Days of glory, they are just a memory. Now days of glory, I'm the king of nobody.
Books Boys was presented by The Dean and PJ Burke in association with Thaddeus Penguin Productions. This episode was brought to you by our sponsor.
Is it Fairy Tales?
If you would like to get in touch, you can email us at booksboys@hotmail.com or visit us at booksboys.com. The intro uses Driving in the 70s from the Of Soundtracks and Garage Bands EP by Trapdoor. And the outro uses Dog's Light by Bravo Max from the album of the same name. All music used is either Podsafe or used with permission. If you'd like to support the show, go to patreon.com/booksboys, get the show early and all of our bonus Boof Fan the Boys shows. And you can also check out our music on Spotify or Apple Music. Thank you kindly for listening to us. Please tell your friends. And come back next time for another episode of Books Boys. Read some books!
Are we having this again? Is every single episode just going to be the same, like, 5 minutes? I feel like people are thinking we just cut and paste it and then eventually kind of add something. It's like the same rhythm. Maybe we got this train, though.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.